So let's start. So let me first welcome you to this week's colloquium. So this week we are very happy to have Nigel Hitchin giving the colloquium. This week, as many of you know, there is an exciting conference related to the topic of the colloquium, and we thought it would be a good idea that will give us a colloquium to a broad audience of the Institute what topic of the conference is. So let me tell you something about Nigel. So Nigel is a professor at the University of Oxford. He got his undergraduate and PhD there under the supervision of Michael Attia. He has many extremely well-known results that have inspired many of us that work in physics and mathematical physics, and mathematics, of course. And he has received many honors and awards that I will not spend the time to list. So we're really happy to have him. So today he's going to talk about the Hitchin system, past and present.
And thank you for the invitation to give this colloquium. I think most mathematicians find it a bit difficult to when they use their own name as an adjective. But this is the title of this week's conference. And no point getting around it. In fact, many years ago, there was a famous algebraic topologist named Frank Adams. And he was giving a talk at a conference. He talked about the so-called Adams spectral sequence. And then the next speaker spoke about the so-called Adams spectral sequence. And so it went on. So let's just stick with it. So the problem with talking to a more general audience about this is trying to give a simple example, motivating example. And there are certain difficulties. So in particular, So Thomas Hausl, so this is a slide from his thesis. And, you know, in your thesis, you're supposed to give examples of this stuff we're talking about. And as he says, unfortunately, the smallest case is still, standard case is still rather large. So he introduced the two-point model. So I thought I would begin this talk with introducing you to the toy model. Now, in fact, last year was my 74th birthday, and Tomas gave me a present. He gave me a toy model. So this is, if you like, this is this. Well, let me explain this. So what do you see? Okay, in the previous picture, you saw a torus. Right, various colored bands on it. This is a more dynamical picture, so keep watching. Right, so what did you see there? So you saw torus being swept out by a pair of circles, which somewhere in the middle become involved with five different circles. So what is this? Incidentally, this was produced for me by Andy Hansen, old friend, former physicist, and became a computer graphic. Anyway, let me try and explain what this represents. First of all, this is a two-dimensional real object. And the actual object which I want to talk about here as a toy model is a two-dimensional complex. So this is what it is. So you take an elliptic curve, complex one-dimensional torus, and you look at the involution. It's a group. The involution u goes to minus u. This has four fixed points. And then you take the product of that with the complex numbers, and you extend the involution to minus one on everything. And this now, again, has four isolated points. Then you take the quotient by the involution. So you identify pairs of points which are related by plus or minus. Now, when you do that, you get four singularities. And so you blow those up, and you get a smooth manifold, which in fact, has a symplectic formant. So dz wedge du is a symplectic formant E cross C, but when we divide out by the involution and blow up again, then actually it still becomes complex. So this is a two complex dimensional symplectic manifold. And it has, in particular, it has the natural function on it, namely z squared. So this is invariant under z goes to minus z. So it's well defined on the quotient. And it has the property that the inverse image of the non-zero point is a copy of the elliptic curve. But the inverse image of zero is, well, first of all, you have the elliptic curve over zero, but you have to identify. As we know, when you take an elliptic curve and identify plus minus 1, then this is the projective line. This is effectively the bias p function. Then the blowing up of those four points gives you four more copies of the projective line. So that's complex manifold, a complex symplectic manifold with a map to a proper map to numbers. Generic fiber is the curve, but special fiber involves lots of different. So the picture you saw, the dynamical picture, was the real slice of it. So you have to think of what are the real points of a torus? So, well, it's a pair of circles. So up here, kind of geometrical picture, you look at the reflection about the plane as the complex negation in the torus, so the fixed point. Pair of circles. Maybe more familiarly, if you think of an elliptic curve as a cubic, of course, real cubic, this one's there, and this together with the other circle. So what you saw there on the real torus was that pair of circles is actually the real points of an elliptic curve. And they were moving, and they moved according to time was basically z squared. And so it goes from positive to negative. But what happens when they hit in the middle? So then we have to think about what is the real version of blowing up a point. First of all, you take, say, a piece of paper and identify a point, cut it in half, then cone, but resolving the cone, blowing up singularity, means replacing that singularity by a circle. So here you see the circle, inner circle there, is the elliptic curve modulo 1. These are the four blown up points. Give you the four. Minus 2. So that's what this is. I mean, there are other features of it. See, so there's your elliptic curve. We're varying z squared. Here, z zero goes positive. The asymptotically. Okay, so that is the toy model. Now, what is the real thing? Well, the real thing involves objects which have now become called Higgs bundles. And here, straight off, is what a Higgs bundle is. So we have a Riemann surface, algebraic curve, if you like, a vector bundle on it, holomorphic vector bundle, E, together with a Hermitian metric. When you have a holomorphic structure and a Hermitian metric, then you have a connection, curvature. But then we have this other object, the Higgs field, which is basically a matrix with values in the differential, canonical bundle. And there's an equation which satisfied, a nonlinear equation, which there's a curvature is obtained in this quadratic fashion. So whenever I put something like this up in general audience, I know you're more of an expert audience than most, perhaps, then the question that I'm usually asked is, what's this got to do with the Higgs boson? And the only answer I can give is this. This is the closest I ever got to the Higgs boson. Okay, so what I'd like to do, so my title was Past and Present. What I'd like to do is actually to give you like a historical origin, personal historical origin, about where these equations came from and where various features of the integrable system I'm going to be talking about, how they arose. So it wasn't exactly a straight line path. So this is the past part of my title, and the present at the end, I'll talk about one particular aspect of current investigations, which I find particularly interesting. So for me, this story goes back 40 years. In fact, to the time that I first, if you like, interacted with physicists in an effective way, and that was in studying So this is a long time ago, 40 years. So we're on Euclidean four space, and we have a connection on a bundle over this. So this is effectively given by four skew emission matrices, well, functions on R4 with values in skew emission matrices, and you take four derivatives, covariant derivatives, these differential operators, and define the curvature. And then the equations are the Self-Yule-Yang-Mills equations by these equations. In a more invariant language, it's given by saying that curvature and self-dual, the star operator, two forms, four dimensions. And the boundary conditions that were given to us, if you like, physicists, were that the norm squared of the curvature be finite, four. And one was asked to study solutions to these modular gauge equivalence, this functions to the group, unit group, gauge. So, along with other mathematicians, we were able to sort this out using some quite time, at least. So after that, I got interested in another problem. It came from the physics community, magnetic monopole. So in this case, you're in three dimensions, and you have a connection in three dimensions. So that's given by three pure joint matrices. And now there's a fourth field. So this is where I first encountered the term Higgs field, provided by the physicist. So this is now a scalar field, but values skew emission matrix. Now we have three components, and the equations which are to be satisfied are these. So coupled equation for extra field. Now they, of course, formally speaking, what I wrote down there, very closely related to what I wrote before on Anti-Self-Yule-Yang-Mills. And indeed, the equations themselves are equivalent to saying that we have a solution to the Self-Yule-Yang-Mills, which are invariant, suitable sense, under translation in the fourth direction. And then the connection term in the covariant derivative, x4 direct, then becomes Higgs. And then now the boundary condition three solutions to this finite. And there are dual solutions for Bogomolny equations. And one can use different methods to find solutions using boundary conditions. So, in fact, as I started to work out how to do this by using Penrose's twist. But when I was halfway through it, more or less the end, a paper of Werner Naum landed on my desk, which gave an outline of alternative way of looking using ordinary differential equations. And so there were these two different views. So we had, the background then was we had instantons, monopoles, and we had Naum's equations coming in as an alternative means of being solutions given boundary. So at the time, a little bit later, there was a paper that drew my attention by Corrigan and Goddard. They pointed out what they called reciprocity. So some curious relationship between four dimensions, k-dimensional, 4 minus k. They pointed out that the construction that I was involved with basically reduced the nonlinear system of partial differential equations, 4 with certain boundary conditions, to a nonlinear problem using matrices. So that was going from 4 dimensions to 0 dimensions. On the other hand, Naum's construction said that you could solve the 3-dimensional Bogomolnik by using a transform which took you to a 1-dimensional nonlinear equation. So they raised the question, without properly addressing it, of is there some theory which goes from 2-dimensional to 2-dimensional? So that kind of stuck in my head for a bit, although I didn't have time wrongly. But then, in fact, there was such an equation, and it had been written down long before that. So this is a paper written, physics paper written in 1967, and you'll see is basically these equations. I'll write them out later. These are the equations that where the consequences of which we're talking about week. As you see, they're written down by a physicist, but this was the killing line in the paper. The model is not interesting. Zero. So the equations were expensive, and what it meant was that if you looked at the action in this case, if you looked at the norm squared of curvature plus covariant derivative of Higgs field, on R2, and asked for them to be finite R2, then there were no solutions except trivial. So the natural boundary conditions for this system of equations, 2 dimensions, gave no solution. But what are the equations? Formally speaking, the equations are very similar to the instanton equations, monopole. Now we have a connect 2, and given by A1 and A2, and we have 2 Higgs fields. So these are the equations you get when you take anti-self dual equations and impose variance of the translation direct, remaining 2 direct 2. So 2 covariant derivatives, direct 3 and X4, basically become. So the curvature, we get a single curvature, F2, and the equations that you can work with. You can rearrange them. And in particular, because you're in 2 dimensions, you can think in terms of So 2 of those equations fit together into a single equation, which is looks very much like a Cauchy-Riemann equation. And in fact, is a Cauchy. If you say that the connect given by Nabla 1 and Nabla 2 actually defines holomorphic structure, is the D bar operator. And so if you put in the complex coordinate Z, then you can reformulate this. You, instead of thinking of the phi being now 2 field values in the algebra, if you multiply by Z, think of this now as a one form with values in the Lie algebra, then the equations actually now make perfect sense on any Riemann surface. So F is now two form with values in the algebra. This commutator here is again a two form, so the equation is balanced. We don't need to look at R2. We can bend it formally and wrap it up, find it. But it's the conformal invariance means that actually we don't need to talk about action, norm squared of the curvature, that would involve choosing. So these are the equations. So these are the way that the Higgs bundle equations basically came to as being derivations by dimensional reduction from the anti-self-dual. But I started playing around with these. But in fact, the sign here confused me, because actually, if you replace that sign by a minus, then of course you get very similar equations, which have a more immediate geometrical impact. They correspond to harmonic map, from a surface into a Lie group, and you can reformulate lots of classical questions like minimal surfaces in the three sphere. The Gauss map of a constant mean curvature surface. All sorts of classical geometric problems can be reformulated way, but that's minus. So after a few false starts, I realized there is a difference. I put it to one side because I spent a year. Almost a year on sabbatical at Stonybrook. There I got talking to the physicist Martin Rocek in particular about a construction that they had, which became known as the hypothetical quotient. So let me just explain this a little bit. So this is all about quaternions, about doing geometry, if you like, over the. So we know that quaternions given by objects IJK. So we have a manifold. So here I'm going to define what a hypothetical manifold is. Manifold T is the tangent space, and we have the operation of the quaternions into more automorphisms, tangent bundle, satisfy these famous equations, bridge doubling, and we have a metric G, and which is compatible with each of these structures. Which gives us three Hermitian forms, omega 1, omega 3. This is Hermitian with respect to I, this is A. And this data is called hyperkähler if these forms. So it's a fact that implies that I, J, and K are integrable. So at the time, there were very few examples of hyperkähler. In four dimensions, the number which out work, for example, of Gibbons and Hawking, Euclidean gravity, but there really weren't very difficult to actually find any, very many. But the construction that came out of it actually generated a lot. So it involves symplectic reduction. So I know many of you in the audience know about this. So if I have a symplectic manifold with an action of a group preserving the form, then every element of the Lie algebra defines corresponding vector field. Vector field preserves the vector form. And under good circumstances, that's the Hamiltonian sense. There's a moment map, there's a function which field in this way. So when you put all those together, then you get a moment map being the symplectic manifold dual algebra. And well, you call it a moment map, it's variant natural axis G. And then the result is that if you take the inverse image of zero under the moment map, divide out by the actual group, under good circumstances, manifold, and it becomes a simplex. So when you have a hyperkeller manifold, then you have three, one omega 3. And so if you have an action of the group G, a Lie group G that preserves all three, then you get three moment maps. And so you get a map from M, the dual of the Lie algebra, three times. And then the result is the inverse zero divided by G. So this the original way of seeing this was various supersymmetry, but by discussing three, we've realized it in a number of ways, and in a rather simple extension of the vector quotient. Well, at the time, there was a lot of work going on using moment maps in infinite dimensions. And the model for this was actually a paper of Atiyah and Bott, where they approached the famous theorem of Narasimhan and Seshadri by using infinite dimensional moments. So from their point of view, you started with a compact surface, and you looked at this infinite dimensional space next on a the C infinity principle. Stay with UN. Now this is what is a connection? Well, the difference of any connections, the one form with values, the algebra. So actually this is a flat affine space, basically. And if this has a complex structure on it, this is a Riemann surface, then it's a complex. But it's also a Kähler, because if we use the variant forms, we're using the unit. So if I look at trace AB, we'd use the Killing form more generally, then this skew form, so A dot and B dot are actually one form, values of the algebra, skew symmetric, A and B, then this defines an infinite dimensional normal Kähler space. Now there's a group acting on it, an infinite dimensional group engaged. And if you look at it formally, then the Lie algebra is the second Lie algebra bundle, dual by integration, two forms, values in the Lie algebra. And what they pointed out was curvature is at the moment. So the symplectic quotient of this is the moduli space flat connection. Start with an infinite dimensional, rather trivial space, but taking the quotient, you get something which is in fact finite, but automatically has a symplectic form. So the symplectic geometry of this space appeared to this. And if you looked at it from the point of view of holomorphic structures, then the analog of the work on moment map quotient geometry told you that what you expect to do is to get stable bundles. So this was Simon Donaldson's paper, adapting this infinite dimensional point of view and using analysis estimates to give a new proof. So at the time, this particular view of moment map gauge theory was very much. So basically what I did was to think of the classification. So now so we have A as before, space connect by complex structure, the 0-1 form. So there's a tangent space here, consists of 0-1 forms. And then to take the cotangent space of this affine space, which is now a complex symplectic manifold, which is just, of course, since it's an affine space, it's just the product of the space of connections with the dual space of the tangent bundle. And then look at, so a pair of objects in here is a D bar operator, a complex structure on A, and a Higgs field, except now it's just C infinity at the moment. And we think of this now as an infinite dimensional hyperkähler manifold. We have now the gauge theory, the gauge group acting on it, and it turns out that if you look at the holomorphic symplectic structure built out of omega 2 and omega 3, then the moment map is this complex object here. And if you look at the Kähler structure, omega 1, the moment map is this. So setting these two equal to zero is precisely finding a solution to these equations. But more than that, it tells you that if you can solve the equations, then the moduli space, the space of equivalences under gauge equivalence, should actually have a hyperkähler metric. So this was a way in which it was possible to find, in fact, finite dimensional hyperkähler metrics by an infinite dimensional process. So when I, after I came back from Stony Brook, at the time, actually, Michael Atiyah got me involved in applying this idea to the moduli space of monopoles, and then we worked out the hyperkähler metric on the moduli space of two monopoles. But then I started thinking about these equations, in these two-dimensional equations, because clearly there was a formalism which meant that if we could find solutions to these equations, if we could find whatever parameterizes solutions to these equations, then we will get some new hyperkähler manifolds. So the problem then was to prove existence. Well, I'm not going to give you the full details, but historically what this is a natural way to think, really. First of all, if you start with a rather trivial solution, so if the Higgs field is zero, then these equations just tell you that you've got a flat connection. And finding flat connections on a surface is very easy because they're characterized up to automorphism by their holonomy, which is a representation of the fundamental group. So all you have to do is to take some matrices which satisfy an algebraic relation like this. These are the commutators of the matrices, the multiplicative commutators, and you have a space of flat connections. But then if you use an infinite dimensional implicit function theorem, you can certainly see that for small values of phi, you can find solutions to these equations. And that was the place that I started, and that was the point at which I spoke about it here. But then pretty soon, by analogy with the other types of equations, with the Narasimhan-Seshadri theorem, it became clear that actually you needed, instead of taking phi rather small and E stable, you could actually impose some joint stability condition. And then, so then what happens, you have this notion of stability of a vector bundle together with a Higgs field, which says that if you have a phi invariant subbundle, then the slope or the degree over the rank must be less than this. So this is a direct generalization of the well-known notion of stability for just holomorphic bundles without the Higgs field. So with that then, I wrote a paper which dealt with the rank 2 situation, SU2. But then Carlos Simpson, who had been approaching these equations from a different point of view, involving a variation of Hodge structure, he generalized it to higher dimensions and gave more aspects to it. So the result was that actually this stability condition was sufficient to guarantee that you had a metric for which the equations held. And what did that do? That said that actually this moduli space of solutions to certain gauge invariant equations could actually be described without reference to the metric just in terms of holomorphic geometry. We just have to look at the pairs of objects which were stable. Okay, so that actually in even this week, I mean the expression Hitchin system has been used in different ways. Sometimes people use it to refer to those equations, but it more specifically it involves a property of the moduli space which essentially comes down to understanding the properties of the characteristic polynomial. So if you have, so now remember our Higgs field phi is a global object, but locally it looks like a holomorphically varying matrix with values in the differentials, the canonical bundle. So if I take the characteristic polynomial, then the coefficients of this are actually, they're not functions, they're sections of powers of the canonical bundle. So these are certain well-known finite dimensional spaces on a Riemann surface. And, okay, so this question of stability arises. So in particular, if you had an invariant subbundle, then the characteristic polynomial would factorize. So that means that the curve defined by this equation would actually be reducible. So if this equation defines an irreducible curve, a smooth one, let's say, then certainly we know that we're talking about stable objects. So this thing, this is called the spectral curve. The equation, the solution, the curve in the cotangent bundle of sigmas, given by this equation. So it's an algebraic curve of a certain genus. And as I say, if it's irreducible, then we know that it came from something which was stable. So, okay, so now one of the fundamental techniques in proving theorems about gauge theory was the Uhlenbeck's weak compactness theorem. So typically, I mean, they arose most interestingly in four dimensions in instantons where you have the bubbling off phenomenon, which for Donaldson gave him a boundary to his moduli space, which started all the work on Donaldson theory. But in two dimensions, you don't get the bubbling off phenomenon. So it may look rather technical, but the aim in trying to get an existence theorem is to, in two dimensions, is to try and get a bound, an L2 bound on the curvature of a connection. If you get an L2 bound on the curvature, then you can find weakly convergent subsequences, you can use elliptic regularity to modify that, and you can hope to get convergent sequences. So what one does in trying to get a theorem of existence is to start with a sequence. So you're trying to find, you're trying to minimize this. Well, so basically one tries to see whether you can get zero for this expression by looking at a sequence on a complex gauge orbit, and you hope that you'll get a minimum for which this is zero. So the idea is you start with such a minimizing sequence. So you have a bound on this, but the aim is to get a bound on the L2 norm of Fn. And so what goes into this? Well, first of all, when you have something which is holomorphic in this Hermitian situation, there's always what's called the Weizenbach formula, which involves the relationship between the curvature and the norm squared of the derivative. So in this situation, what it does is to give you this. It gives you a bound on this part in terms of the norm squared of the Higgs field. So that's not enough. But then this is where the characteristic polynomial comes in, because this is a very simple statement that if I have a complex n by n matrix, I know that if it commutes with its adjoint, then it's a normal matrix, and so it can be diagonalized by a unitary matrix. So if I know the characteristic polynomial, then I know what the diagonal entries are here. So what that means is that actually if I have a matrix A whose norm is 1, the characteristic polynomial and the norm of the commutator, they can't vanish simultaneously. So what that means is that if I have bounds on the characteristic coefficients of the characteristic polynomial and bounds on the commutator here, then I get bounds on A itself. So this, for me, was where actually the coefficients of the characteristic polynomial first arose. And what it meant is that actually you can, okay, if you go back, well, you know, there's a different degree of homogeneity here, which works in your favor. So bounds on the characteristic polynomial, this bound on phi and star, gives you a bound on this, and then you can put it in this, and you eventually get a bound on Fn. So that was a key feature in actually finding a minimum, which would give me a solution to the equations. But once you're at a minimum, well, if you have that's the first statement. But if you actually have a sequence now of solutions, so if you have a sequence like this, then the same argument says that actually if you have a bound on the coefficients of the characteristic polynomial, then you get convergence. So what this means is that we have this moduli space of solutions to the equations. This, there's a map here to the collection of coefficients of the characteristic polynomial, that this is actually a proper map. If I had a bounded region down here, the inverse image is bounded upstairs, is compact upstairs. So that actually, for me, was a key feature of the characteristic polynomial, that it gave a proper map from what was obviously a non-compact manifold onto a vector space. That was really the start of the integrable system. Now, in fact, I'd done already quite a lot of work on the equations, and the integrable system was actually born in Canada, so a long way from here. Well, so it's okay. So it was here. So I was visiting a former student of mine, Jacques Hauterbees, in Montreal, and we went up to his cottage in the Laurentian Mountains. And as he was doing some work on the cottage, I was sitting on the porch and thinking about this integral. I was thinking about this proper map that we have a complex symplectic manifold. It was a hyperkähler manifold, so in particular, it's complex symplectic, and we had a map to a vector space. So, and it reminded me of what I learned vaguely about integrable systems. And then I suddenly realized that the functions that you get by mapping onto this vector space actually Poisson commuted. So, in fact, that evening we tried to figure out how it worked in the case of genus 2, but we really didn't get anywhere. And as a matter of fact, so this was the situation. Okay, so the moduli space is complex symplectic. We have this proper map, P, going to the vector space. And for very general reasons, it turns out that each of these functions, a pair of functions, Poisson commute. So which means that in particular, the generic fiber, the fiber at a regular value, is a complex torus. The Hamiltonian vector fields of all these functions actually span the tangent space at each point. So it took a while, you know, before actually a specific example was given. So we were working on this in around 1984, 85 or so, but it wasn't until the mid to late 90s that someone actually wrote down in concrete terms one of these things. So this was, there were some algebraic geometers together with physicists who did this. So this is the situation of a curve of genus 2, so that's a hyperelliptic curve. We take 6 points in the projective line, and we have this equation for the hyperelliptic curve. We look at, first of all, you have to understand, you need some coordinates, if you like, in order to write down an integrable system explicitly. And so you look at the moduli space of Higgs bundles for a rank 2 bundle with trivial determinant bundle. And it had been known for a long time that actually the moduli space of these, so this is the case where the Higgs field is equal to 0, is actually P3. And so then it means that there's a large open set inside the moduli space, which is the cotangent bundle of P3. And you can describe the cotangent bundle of a projective space in a very natural way. Well, it's a symplectic quotient, really. So you look at pairs P and Q, such that P is not equal to 0, and the natural pairing is equal to 0, dividing by the C star action, the natural scaling here, and its inverse there. And then, so this is the final form of Gavinsky and his collaborator. So this is the system. So what is this on the right-hand side? This is a quadratic differential on the hyperelliptic curve. That's what the x parameter is. And we have this quartic expression on the top in terms, well, it's quadratic, I guess, in terms of P and Q. And this sigma ij is actually a matrix. So it's a very natural description. So sigma I, so if you go back here and look at this expression here, if I take a rank 2 bundle like this and tensor with a line bundle whose square is trivial, then this condition is satisfied. That means that on this moduli space, there's an action of a group of order 2 to the 2g, 2 to the 4th, z2 to the 4th acting on this space here. It acts on a vector space, so it's actually a central extension, which a kind of finite Heisenberg group, which acts on V. And what this sigma ij says that actually if you take a pair xi and xj and consider the two ramification points in the hyperelliptic curve, the difference of those is of order 2, so it defines a line bundle of order 2, this is the action. And because you've got a square there, it's actually independent of the central extension, which is just by plus or minus 1. So everything is very natural. So this is the genus 2 example of this integrable system. So so you have this 3g minus 3. You have three coefficients essentially here, and they Poisson commute. Now, you know, the fact that this was quite a struggle to get to an explicit formula is somehow a reflection on the fact that that we started with the geometry. And so, but that's in some ways the power of the fact that this thing exists. Because you see, all it means is that if you take any simple Lie group, say, and any Riemann surface, then you have an integrable system. If you want to write it down, what have you got to do? You've got to choose some kind of coordinates. In this case, cotangent bundle of the moduli space of stable bundles. That means you've got to choose some coordinates on the moduli space of stable bundles. It's only in very specific cases that you can really write down these systems. So it's coming at it from the other point of view. I mean, typically, an integral system comes to you as a set of differential equations, which you require to discover some geometry underlying them. This goes the other way around. It produces a vast number of integrable systems, and the challenge, if you want to accept that challenge, is to write them down in some concrete fashion. So these torus fibers are, in fact, algebraic tori, they're abelian varieties. Let me just say finally the Higgs field in physics is, okay, so it's a symmetry-breaking object, right? Mass is supposed to appear from breaking the symmetry. The Higgs field in this setup it does the same sort of thing in the sense that it breaks the symmetry from the group G to generically to its maximal torus. And that's somehow related to these torus fibers. So that's in a sense, the past. Okay, I've taken up 50 minutes talking about the past. So the present and the future are represented by lots of people in the audience, I think, who are here in particular for this meeting. There are a lot of questions that I'm interested in at the moment relevant to this this integrable system. And a lot of them come from trying to understand the predictions of mirror symmetry. So it turns out that there's one particular version of mirror symmetry which fits the Higgs bundle moduli space in a very natural fashion. And so one can try and see what it tells us about various problems, and this is an interesting challenge. So so let's recall that that mirror symmetry is supposed to, on a Calabi-Yau manifold, is supposed to interchange features of the A model, which we think of as symplectic geometry, and the B model, which is complex geometry. And a hyper-Kähler manifold is a particular, rather special case of a Calabi-Yau manifold, and so it's a relevant object to study mirror symmetry. Now, the particular mirror symmetry that applies very well to it is the Strominger-Yau-Zaslow approach. So it was originally formulated for Calabi-Yau manifolds, in which case you look for what's called a special Lagrangian vibration, and then the mirror is supposed to be the dual vibration. So let me just say what that means, that if you have a torus, so if you have a special Lagrangian vibration by tori, that means that essentially you have an integrable system, then the idea of mirror symmetry here is to replace the torus by its dual torus. So the dual torus is the space of flat unitary line bundles on the original torus. So you can think of that as the homomorphisms from the fundamental group to U1. So it's this. So the NFT is has an algebraic structure. If it's an abelian variety, then so is the dual. So the conjecture, or the fact that was proved by Donaghy and Pantev, is that the Higgs bundle moduli space for a group G, simple group G, should be the mirror of it should be another Higgs bundle moduli space, but for the Langlands dual group LG. So Langlands duality for the group is supposed to represent mirror symmetry according to the SYZ mirror symmetry picture. And so the challenge is to try and test that in particular situations. So in our case, the generic fiber is this abelian variety. It's essentially in the general linear group case, it's just the Jacobian of the spectral curve. So what does it mean to be an abelian variety? It means that it's actually embedded in some large projective space. So in particular, you could take a line bundle, a positive line bundle on Pn, restricted to T, and then look at the operation of translation in order to get a homomorphism, basically from the abelian variety to its dual. So you translate the hyperplane bundle and then multiply by its inverse to get a degree zero line bundle. And so you get a homomorphism with finite kernel from T to T hat. So, you know, the distinction between an abelian variety and its dual, it depends on the way you look at it, but sometimes it's only a question of looking at rather carefully at the kernel of such a map. So what it meant in this situation was that there was a natural way that the fiber in the fashion which is natural over the base, the generic fiber of the Lie group G moduli space is actually the dual of the fiber in this case. So I want to just give you an implication of this in another context, which gives a result, and which I think is rather surprising. So this all relates to another feature of this Higgs bundle moduli space, which relates to character varieties. So we now dispense with the holomorphic picture and go back to the equations. So if we know that we have a stable Higgs bundle, then we know that there exists a metric such that we have these solution to these equations. One consequence of that is that if I write this down, then this is actually a flat connection. And the moduli space of flat connections, of course, is the, it depends what sort of homomorphisms, reductive homomorphisms, modulo conjugation action. This is effectively another way of looking at M. So M has this hyperkähler structure. One of the complex structure J is essentially that of the character variety, the moduli space of irreducible the big open set is irreducible flat connections, irreducible representations of the fundamental group. Anyway, this is another viewpoint on the same moduli space. And one particular issue is this. Suppose I look at a real form of the complex group. So, for example, split real form, say SLNR inside SLNC. Then you could ask, well, what does this look like in the Higgs bundle moduli space picture? And it turns out to be a complex submanifold, but it's one which wraps around and intersects the generic fibers in a finite number of points. In fact, it intersects a generic fiber in the points of order 2. So we have all this discrete family of points in a generic fiber, each of which gives us in the character variety complex structure, gives us a representation into SLNR. So, on the other hand, we know that there can be topological invariance of a flat connection. So, for example, if we look at SLNR, then its maximal compact subgroup is SON. And we know that if we have an SON bundle over a surface, then, for example, there's a second Stiefel-Whitney class. There's a mod 2 invariant. That's not apparent at all. When you think of it as an SLNC bundle, because the maximal compact of this is SUN, and that's simply connected. So, for example, topological invariance of flat connections should appear somehow in separating out these elements of order 2 in the generic fiber. Well, actually, for SON, for SLNR, it's a slightly complicated picture. It's much easier for the case of the real symplectic group. So the real symplectic group has a maximal compact subgroup UN. And so UN, if you have a UN bundle on a surface, it's got a first Chern class, which is an integer. So any flat SP to NR connection has this integer invariant associated to it. And you can ask, well, how does that realize itself in these elements of order 2 in the prim variety, in the generic fiber, which actually turns out to be what's called a prim variety. So in this case, the eigenvalues of something in the Lie algebra of the symplectic group occur in pairs, which means the spectral curve has an involution. It only involves even powers. And it turns out that the generic fiber consists of line bundles on this spectral curve such that the involution takes the line bundle into its dual. So that's called the prim variety, PSS bar. So S bar is the quotient curve under this involution. Now, if we're interested in this group here, then we're looking at elements of order 2. So that means that line bundles whose square is trivial. So that means that L dual is isomorphic to L. So there we've got the pullback of L is isomorphic to L. So that means that at a fixed point on the spectral curve, we have this involution. It gives us an action on the fiber at that fixed point, which is either plus 1 or minus 1. And so you have this 2 to the whatever it is points, and you can partition them into groups according to the number of plus 1 points and the number of minus 1 points under this action. And there's a formula, well, a linear formula, which relates that directly to this Chern class. Now, suppose we think of mirror symmetry as it applies to this particular space, then Langdon's duality is, I mean, the most mysterious aspect of Langdon's duality is, of course, is the duality between the symplectic group and the odd orthogonal group. So the duality somehow is more apparent at the root system level, but when it comes to the groups themselves, it's rather difficult to understand what duality really means. So what happens? Well, in this case, what have we got? Well, we on the dual picture, the split real form is SOM plus 1N, and the maximal compact of that is, well, there may be some mod 2 invariants, but there's certainly no integer invariant, no Chern class. Nevertheless, the dual, so I said that in general, the dual of an abelian variety, you could identify it with the abelian variety modulo some finite subgroup. In this case, it's actually the quotient by the pullback of the elements of order 2 on the quotient curve. And so we have a partition of this in different sets of points of order 2, and that actually passes over to this, because actually if the anything which is pulled back from S bar is acted on trivially at every fixed point. So the partition passes over to this. So what it means is that there's an integer invariant for a flat SON plus 1 N connection. Okay, and why it's an invariant, this is discrete data. Okay, so I've talked about a generic fiber, and if I move that fiber slightly, then the number of points with plus ones or minus ones will not change. If I vary the curve slightly, if I change its complex structure, that won't change. So it's some integer invariant. So it's something which is which mirror symmetry tells us is there, but it's not apparent from any other direct means. Except, in fact, that just last year there was a thesis by a student in Urbana-Champaign. One of the consequences of which was proving that there are connected components of this SON plus 1N character variety which are parameterized by integers within a particular range. So if you like, you can think of this as a kind of verification of something which was apparent from mirror symmetry. So this is one of many problems or many questions which some of which are very difficult to resolve, but mirror symmetry predicts the existence of certain corresponding objects on one side, on the side of the Higgs bundles for group G and those for the Langdon's dual group. And sometimes, as in this case, it says very quickly that there is something to be understood in a completely different arena, in this case, in the topology of flat connections or representations of the fundamental group. Well, there are many, many more such questions, and this week has been devoted to lots of issues related to this Hitchin system. But I've just isolated just one of them here. But the future, as I say, the future lies basically amongst a lot of the people who are perhaps sitting in this audience. Okay, so thanks.
Thank you. We have time for comments or questions. Well, as you mentioned, this Hitchin system also appears in a computation of minimal areas or symmetric spaces, like spheres or like hyperbolas. Can you comment a little bit on the implications of this kind of results for non-trivial results concerning areas of minimal surfaces?
what seems to be a minor issue in terms of the sign actually has big implications. So the minimal surface issues, well, I mean, it depends. There are different. The one that I commented on was basically looking at minimal surfaces in a positively curved space like the three sphere. And in that case, you can try and imitate some of the aspects here, but the there's no good moduli space. I mean, so for example, if you look at a torus, there are lots of there were lots of outstanding questions about minimal tori in the three sphere. In principle, there's a kind of infinite dimensional space, but you have to cut it down in different ways. So these techniques don't. The point of view has its limits. So the gauge theory point of view can be very useful. In fact, you can reformulate some of these questions in terms of, in fact, geodesics in the moduli space of flat unitary connections. But in practical terms, it's less important. So the minus sign essentially comes from dimensional reduction from four dimensions with signature 2, 2. And this ultra-hyperbolic system, it means that, it's very difficult to use any elliptic type of theory there. And although when you come down to a Riemann surface, the metric might be positive definite on the surface side, nevertheless, somehow the complications appear when you're looking at the analysis. So no, you were talking about maybe minimal surfaces in the negatively curved spaces, which is perhaps more related to this. But one of the really perplexing issues is to what extent you can deduce results without using the existence of these equations. I mean, the equations link these two points of view. They link the character variety and the Higgs bundle moduli space. It's a very powerful tool because in the Higgs bundle moduli space, you have lots of complex subvarieties which have implications in the character variety, which is an affine variety. But to know to what extent you can make relations without using the equations is a kind of challenge. So some of the things that Hausel has been doing seems to suggest that even the arithmetic properties know about the relationship without actually having to go through the differential equations. That may not have answered your question.
So in this particular example at the end, is there a conjecture for grade 2 or grade?
A conjecture? So as I say, Collier actually did the standard, what is now quite a sophisticated apparatus, is looking for minima in the character variety. I mean, using Higgs bundle theory, looking for minima of the norm squared of the Higgs field, and then characterizing components, and then proving connectedness of components. You might say it's an artificial point of view that, for example, on the one hand, I had a Chern class which was distinguishing these components. And you might say, well, the Chern class is something which comes to us from another part of algebraic topology, so long as you prove that that there are different components, then the actual component is a topological, distinguishing component is a topological invariant. You don't have to have some algebraic topological object to do it. And in some respects, that's equally true for SLNR. We know that there are two components. There's this Teichmuller component and the other component. You might say that there's a topological invariant that distinguishes the two. But I think it raises, because it's so close to the obvious topologically variant for a symplectic group that somehow I feel that it ought to be more visible in terms of properties of the holonomy of a flat connection with in SON plus 1N. Now, I mean, other cases probably don't work in the same way, but it would be good to say that a representation in this such and such a component has a property which is derived from this integer invariant.
Not the same.